With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby. Mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa. Take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I've got to play a bit of festive music there to start this show, because actually, I bet you didn't know this, Simon, but I used to be a church organist in my 20s. I was the sort of part-time organist at a local church in Ealing, playing Christmas carols, few hymns, etc., even at people's weddings.
Well, just in case the bowling didn't work out, I can just imagine Jeffrey Boycott listening to that and saying, oh, you should have stuck to playing the organ because you were a useless bowler.
Yeah, well, he might well be right. Although, I don't think my organ playing was much better. Anyway, moving on. Welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Lots in the show today, looking back at Australia-India, the second test match. Also, the start of the Big Bash and some interesting things going on there. We've got your emails and we've got an interview with Derek Pringle, who's got a new book out looking back at the 1980s with lots of intrigue and revelation. So we'll come to that perhaps after the break. But first, Simon... Well, actually, first, before we talk about Australia-India, we should just say we're head-to-head, aren't we, on the Big Bash. You're on BBC Radio and I'm on BT Sport TV. So viewers have got a lovely choice.
I don't think it's a choice at all, is it, Yozza?
Oh, come on. You know, they've got to hear my dulcet tones above your, you know, Bristolian twang. I mean, surely they've got to prefer it.
Well, I'm actually working on the Big Bash for BBC and BT, so sometimes I'll be against you and sometimes I'll be with you, Yoz.
Oh, blah, blah, blah. All right, very good. So you can't get away from Simon, man. That's the sad aspect to it, and you're stuck with him here as well. Look,
thank you very much, Yoz. That's a nice build-up, isn't it?
Australia-India, second test match. Obviously a resounding win by the Australians, 146 runs. I felt the game was a bit tighter, perhaps, than... the score suggests, and I think India just missed a trick by not playing a spinner, because for two reasons. Firstly, a Jadeja would have given them an alternative option to the quick bowlers, and just secondly, their tail started at number eight. Umesh Yadav came in at number eight in one innings and Mohammad Shami in number eight the other. You know, it reminded me of one of the England teams of the 1990s, where they had Mullally, Tufnell, Fraser, Giddens, four number 11s.
Malcolm.
Devon Malcolm, yeah. So it's although you shouldn't pick a team based on how well the batsmen can, but how well the bowlers can bat, it does make you look quite fragile.
Well, look at England. I mean, they've got batsmen who can bat down the order and make up for some of the deficiencies at the top of the order. So, I think things could be changing, you know, when you look at the balance of your side. Of course, it helps with England. The fact they've got all these all-round cricketers, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's a real positive. Sometimes it's seen as a sort of negative for England. They're just a team of all-rounders. What's wrong with that? That sort of multifaceted cricketer. I think it's a really good thing. What I would say about the test match, and actually, I texted you after the first day, and I said 1-1 then, because I just watching it, just seeing the pitch looked a bit cracked, a bit up and down on that first day. I thought you get some decent runs on the board, as Australia did on that first day. What were they, about 270? I thought, good luck batting second, or good good luck batting last. I mean, in a way, the brilliance of Kohli kept India in the game. Fantastic innings. And of course, you know, his dismissal was probably the key moment. That first inning dismissal, that low catch to Peter Hanscombe, was probably the key moment of the game. I thought, out.
Yeah.
I know lots of people didn't, but you know, everyone has an opinion. You know, we've talked about this many times before about how the camera gives an impression that the ball has bounced when often it goes into the fingers, then up into the palm of the hand. I felt it was a good catch. Of course, the umpires did as well. And then it seems to me that what side you were on just depended whether you supported India or Australia. All the Australians, it seemed to me, who were interviewed said, oh, yeah, fair catch. And all the Indians said, no, just a bunch of cheats. Well, I feel I'm totally independent on this. I mean, I love watching Kohli bat. I felt it was out.
Yeah, I did. And I think the umpires got that right, actually. They give it the sort of soft dismissal out. And, yeah, I think, you know, in a way, the initial impression you have is a very strong guide to what has actually happened. It was a brilliant innings by Kohli. I'm just watching the way he defended the ball. You know, there were some seriously good deliveries bowled by Josh Hazlewood. I mean, a great duel, actually, between Kohli and Pat Cummins that lasted for about 7 or 8 overs, a bit like the Anderson-Kohli duel in the summer. And Kohli won that duel. But it was just, you know, Kohli's sort of passion and determination and commitment to the cause was incredible to watch. But his skill as well. And he's becoming more, in some ways, more like Tendulkar in some of the shots he plays. In, you know, how Tendulkar played those sort of what I almost call laser guided shots through the offside, really precision placement. And Kohli's starting to do a lot more of that with less flamboyance in a way than perhaps he's shown earlier in his career. And it was a compelling battle between those Australians and him. And Nathan Lyon, too, was outstanding. I mean, he has made orthodox off-spin a very popular form and a very effective form of bowling. You know, and in Perth as well, which tends to not favour the spinners. Of course, he got Kohli out, a key wicket in the second innings, playing for the ball that didn't turn. The pitch overall, I thought, was also interesting because I was worried that the Perth pitch wouldn't be like the Wacker. Of course, they're playing this test match in the new stadium. And I thought, well, they'll never be able to replicate the Wacker. But they did. They imported the same soil, which is sort of from the banks of the Swan River. And they made it as hard and true and bouncy as the true Wacker pitch is. I suppose, actually, Perth generally, because I've played quite a bit of club cricket in Perth, and a lot of the pitches are very quick. So it's obviously a type of soil that you can make into a very lively pitch, and it made for a very good watch as a test match.
Two matches now, Yoz, and the team batting first has won both matches. We saw in Sri Lanka and in England batting first 3 times and winning 3 times, and we've discussed in the past the importance of winning the toss. Nathan Leeman, who used to do all the stats for the England team, used to say that, or his feeling was, that you actually bat second on good pitches, which is sort of counterintuitive. But if you bat first on pitches that deteriorate, as you know happened in Sri Lanka, as happened at Perth, you've got a very good chance as long as you get decent runs in the first innings. Of course, the focus now is going to be on what sort of surface we are going to get in Melbourne. And there was so much criticism flying around last year. Quite right, too. It was the most utterly tedious test match between England and Australia last year. England 3-0 down in the Ashes. I mean, Alistair Cook enjoyed himself. And it was remarkable to watch him, you know, apply himself and beat his demons, if you like, against that Australian attack. But it was deadly dull, that test match. Let's hope that they've learnt their lesson. I'm sure they will have learnt their lesson from that game. So I imagine there's going to be quite another spicy pitch for the third game.
I hope so. They're talking about eventually importing the soil from Perth to Melbourne to try and do the same job on the Melbourne pitch. And of course, this Perth pitch was a drop-in pitch, so it's grown outside the ground and sort of lowered into position by some huge crane. And I guess they can do that in Melbourne as well. Well, they do have drop-in pitches in Melbourne, but they need to grow them somewhere else in Western Australia. It'd be a bit of a journey for a pitch, wouldn't it? Across Australia from from Perth to Melbourne, across the Nullarbor Plain, take about 4 days or something to get there. God. But they've got big enough trucks to do it. So, you know, I guess it's not beyond their bounds. And how are Australia going? Obviously, they pulled back to 1-1. I think their batting is still pretty fallible. I think Marcus Harris is looking as if he could be the part to open. He's got something, a young player, second test match, got a 70 in the first innings. Yeah, he's definitely got something, I think, which they can build on. But a couple of the others, Finch, that isn't a test player to me, and Peter Hanscom definitely not. So there's one or two kind of concerns there for Australia. The series still very much in the balance.
I can remember David Bumble Lloyd, when he was England coach, on a tour of Zimbabwe. Well, quite a lot of things happened on the tour of Zimbabwe in 1996, including, you know, we flipping murdered them comments at the end. But I can remember him sort of stalking around the boundary edge, watching one of the Zimbabwe players bat, and he said, this man's a walking wicket. And Peter Hanscom comes to mind when I think of that. He just looks like the archetypal David Bumble Lloyd walking wicket to me. He just there's no sense of permanency. He probably come out and get a big score in the third test match. But I don't know how you can bat with that technique. We talked about it last year during the Ashes, you know, right back in your crease. He looks like a right-handed Gary Balance. I think Mike Selby made that point on Twitter the other day, and you're absolutely right. He just looks so vulnerable. I can't believe that this man is in the top six batsmen in Australia. Obviously, they see something in him. It's not to denigrate him as a player. You know, he's obviously got some talent, but that technique, it just does not seem to be working.
Yeah, that's true. It's interesting you bring out Gary Balance there, because our great friend Jeffrey was fond of saying about Balance that there was a chap he played with who moved his front leg more than Balance, and he used to say, and he had a tin leg. So you do need a front foot, you do need a front leg to do some damage in Test cricket with the bat. And, well, Hanscom seems to just play French cricket, you know, steps onto his stumps and kind of defends from there, really, which you can't see it working. The other kind of talking point from the Test match, I suppose, was the verbals that were picked up by the stump microphone. They were actually fairly inoffensive, really, but it was quite interesting to see the confrontation between Kohli and Tim Payne. They squared up once at the non-striker's end. Kohli sort of bared his chest at him slightly. It was a slightly sort of bristly kind of body language. And I know when Tim Payne was batting, Kohli was sort of talking to him, saying, well, you better not fail, mate, because you're going to go to 2-0 down in the series. And Tim Payne, you could hear him on the stump mics retort, you got a bat last on it, Big Ed. So that was quite funny. And then in the second innings, while Payne was standing up to the stumps, he sort of did a bit of an aside to one of the Indian batsmen, saying, I know he's your captain, but he's very hard to like. So it was quite interesting. I'd say inoffensive. And I actually thought Payne came out of that game incredibly well. And Kohli didn't, because he laughed when Payne got a bouncer into his throat and gloved a catch behind. And I just thought Kohli's behaviour, apart from his batting, was a bit excessive.
Well, you can pretty much see what Kohli's thinking the whole time, because, you know, it's there for everyone to see. I actually thought Tim Payne's sledge about, you know, I know he's your captain, but no one can really like him. I thought it was sort of quite clever, really. In a way, that's what, if you are going to sledge, that is quite a good sledge, I think. The idea of sort of going at someone and swearing at them, you know, I just get that out of the game altogether. And actually, I think both Payne and Kohli, didn't they? They made the point that there was, you know, when they were, that the focus was on them coming together, there actually wasn't any swearing. And I suppose they're conscious of the fact the stump mics are up as well. So, you know, any swearing will be picked up. So to some extent, they're on their best behaviour. So they're having to be a bit more creative with the chat that's going on out on the field. You know, they can't help themselves, can they? They have to have a go at it. And you know, we talked about this before the start of the series. You know, and I talked about it as well with Michael Vaughan when we were doing the Cricket Social on BBC. You know, you don't want an Australian side that's toothless, that's emasculated. We've grown up with them. You know, and we sort of love to hate it in a way. What you don't want is that real nastiness out on the field that we saw or heard last year during the Ashes when some, you know, comments that were over the top were made to one or two of the England players, one player in particular, Johnny Bairstow. So that's what you don't want in the game. But I think you know, the comment that Payne made when he was out there fielding to one of the Indian batsmen about, you know, you can't like him, can you?
Yeah.
I wonder I just don't think who it was now. Who was the player?
Murali Vijay.
Vijay was thinking, well, he's in a difficult situation there, isn't he? Either he engages or he says, no, I actually agree with you. I don't know. Difficult
one
for him.
Murali Vijay isn't out there long enough to answer back anyway. Actually, it brings to mind, talking of sort of witty sledges, it brings to mind that great encounter with Merv Hughes, who's often known as the fruit fly, the great Australian pest. And although he had a lot of choice and very basic sledges, there was a classic when he was bowling to Javed Miandad in the 1980s, and Miandad had snicked him for four. And so, you know, Merv Hughes came out with his usual kind of expletive. And Miandad stared down the wicket at him and said, "You're nothing but a fat bus conductor." And two balls later, Hughes got him out, gloved him through to the keeper, and just ran after Miandad afterwards, just slyly said, "Tickets, please."
Those are the good ones, aren't they?
Yeah.
The witty ones. Anyway, massive focus on the third test match. And I think you know, really good for Australian cricket as well after what's happened. You know, it just feels that the series is sort of, you know, it's there. It's sort of in focus and the Australian public are engaging with it. And that's good. I mean, you don't want to, you desperately don't want the Australian cricket public to sort of completely lose interest in their team and in Test cricket. I mean, that'd be awful for the game. Of course, Big Bash has started now, and there's a different focus for spectators and young, perhaps younger spectators, you know, during the summer months, and extended Big Bash this year as well. 59 games, 2 months. You know, you wonder whether that's too much. You know, it's been expanded from 10 group matches to 14 group matches. Everyone plays each other home and away. You know, you've got to be careful with any product that you've got, that you don't sort of oversell it, overexpose it. It'll be interesting to see how that works and whether the attendances stay up and the viewing figures stay up. Remarkable incident in the first match of the competition, where the third umpire, Greg Davison, gave James Pattinson run out when, I mean, it was impossible to give it run out. You couldn't give it run out on the TV pictures. And we had this whole thing where he just stayed in the middle, almost like, no, hold on. It's almost like black was white, or, you know, it's day and it's night. You know, it was incredible, an incredible moment. And then Adelaide strikers actually reversing the appeal and just allowing him to continue. Sort of bizarre moment, really. You just wonder what was going on. I thought he pressed the wrong button.
Yeah, well, so did we. And it's good credit to the Adelaide strikers there, the team led by Colin Ingram, actually, and to a lesser extent Alex Carey, the keeper, that they just basically reinstated James Pattinson. He's allowed to carry on. So that was good. I don't know, sometimes you go back to when the first days of runouts, runouts that were adjudicated by the third umpire, when the slow motion cameras weren't as sophisticated as they are now, and sometimes the bat was between frames. So you could see the bat short of the line when the bails were not off, and then well over the line when the bails were completely off, and you couldn't find the actual point when the bails were actually touched and removed, so they were harder to adjudicate. The key moment was between TV frames, but I mean now they're much more frames per second, so you do get the right moment. And I don't know what the umpire was looking at there, the third umpire. It just must have been cross-eyed or something, because it was so obviously in. But maybe it was another innovation, because certainly the Big Bash has excelled itself with kind of funky new things they brought in, including the flashing bails, and now the bat flip instead of the coin toss. Which there was an irony to that today, because they've made a special bat which is supposed to land. It can either land one side or the other. It hasn't got too much of a ridge on the back, so they've got flats and roofs or something, haven't they?
Flats and hills.
And you call one or the other, and so they called one or the other, and then was it Matthew Hayden who sort of flung the bat out of vision, so you couldn't see what the result was.
Yeah, I was extolling the sort of, you know, the potential virtues of the bat toss. You would actually be able to see who's won the toss, whereas with the coin toss, you can't. You relies on the match referee or, you know, who's ever there to say, oh, it's a head or a tail. And I'm sure in the past, you know, there have been nefarious captains who've flicked a coin and said, oh, no, that is a tail, even though it, you know, might look like a head, and to put it in his pocket and said, well, bat first, you know, on a flat one, bat for 2 days. So, you know, captains, I think, have done that in the past. And of course, with this one, you know, you won't be able to do it. But if it lands out of vision, out of the range of the camera, then it's not great for the public who are viewing at home. So whoever tosses the bat for in future in the tournament just needs to learn the lesson from Matthew Hayden. Don't be too vigorous with the bat drop. But of course, you have to sort of give it a bit of a flick. Otherwise, you know, it'll sort of land as you in the same way as you sort of holding it, I suppose. But anyway, it's a reasonable innovation. I don't think it worked in the first match, but it might well work in the future.
I just hope that the person responsible for producing that particular bat doesn't sort of forget it sometime. I bet they will, because I mean, you know, there was an Ashes 2005 Ashes when the urn is supposed to be presented to the winning captain at the last Test match, and I promise you, the ECB actually didn't have the replica urn to present Michael Vaughan, and it was only because I had one in the Channel 4 VT truck that they were able to actually present an urn to the winning captain. So there is a history of forgetting key items for these games. Listen, that's enough about Australia, I think, anyway, and Australian cricket for the moment. We're going to take a quick break, and afterwards we'll talk about English cricket.
Oh, welcome back to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Well, you cut us off at an interesting point there, Jose. So the Ashes urn for 2005 that Michael Vaughan was holding up, England winning back the Ashes. Well, now we know it's not the real Ashes because they, you know, they are too valuable to give to a grubby Yorkshireman to hold up in the air. the Ashes from 2005, the urn was not even the sort of spanking replica urn. It was one you sort of dug out of your pocket or got from the Channel.
Oh, excuse me, I actually paid good money for it. I went to the Lord's shop and bought a replica urn for £35. Totally overpriced, and I put it in sort of prime viewing position in the Channel 4 truck. So the camera, when they came to me for analysis during between overs or whatever, the Ashes urn was in prominent position, and you could see it there as a little feature. You know, or look at that instead of me, which is probably a good idea. And it was only on the last day that the ECB press officer approached me at about lunchtime, or just after lunch. And I think was it a Sunday or I can't remember if it was a Sunday or a Monday. But anyway, they approached me and they said, can we borrow your urn? We need to present it to the winning captain because we haven't got one. And so, of course, I said, fine. And that's the last I've seen of it. And I haven't had my money for it either. So
that would be worth quite a lot. Yeah. You should
you know,
get that back.
I'll tell you another true story about, and I had another one. I bought another one soon after that series. I went and did a dinner in Liverpool for the Liverpool League Cricket League, and I thought it would be quite nice to, as I was speaking, to sort of pass a replica urn around, because I thought people in Liverpool might not have actually been that close to an urn before, an Ashes urn. And I passed it round, and guess what happened? Someone stole it.
Light.
Someone stole it. Could only happen in Liverpool. Oh, anyway, they were very apologetic, and they sent me a receipt for it, so that was okay.
Well, what you need to do, you need to get that. Where is it? You need to get that off Michael. He must have it somewhere, surely.
Actually, I should.
You need to get it off.
Yes,
it's worth a lot of money.
You're absolutely right. But he's probably offered it up for auction somewhere. So, you know, anyway, let's move on. We should talk of, you know, talking of sort of characters from, you know, history and all that. Derek Pringle has finally been persuaded to produce a book. Now, the reason we're talking about this is, firstly, it's a good book. And secondly, we're offering some free copies of it signed if you email us at the Analyst Podcast email address, which is theanalystpodcast@gmail.com, theanalystpodcast@gmail.com. And we just want you to put in the subject bar Pring and then give us what you think was your highlight of the year. And it can be anything you like. What would you think was the moment of the year in cricket this year? So send that to theanalystpodcast@gmail.com and we'll do a little draw for both the Pringle book and also for the Ashes tickets next year. So if you prefer Ashes tickets, put Ashes in the subject bar. If you fancy Pringle's book, put Pring or Pringle in the subject bar and send us your highlight of the year cricket-wise. we've got a little interview with Pring because he's put a lot of effort into this book. It's called Pushing the Boundaries, Cricket in the 80s. It dispels the myth of him actually getting injured writing a letter, which is a famous story about him when he was playing for England. He claims that he was writing a letter, but he leant back in the chair having finished this letter and pulled a muscle in his back, and that's why he was ruled out of the game. So he was sort of writing a letter, but it was the process of what happened afterwards that caused him to be injured. And one of the interesting stories that he also reveals is that the England team actually were watching a porn movie called Billy's Big Banana during a test match at Lord's, perhaps understandably, when Chris Tavare was batting. So my colleague from the Cricketer magazine, Hugh Turbeville, chatted to him about various matters to do with his book, including this one.
Mates of mine at Cambridge had this film, and I remember telling Lamy about it, Alan Lamb and a few others, and they said, well, bring it along, because Lord's, you know, as the head of most county dressing rooms, it had a video player,
right.
You know, which were kind of new on the scene back then, so... You know, you'd do anything to be one of the lads, won't you?
Yeah.
So I foolishly brought it along.
Yeah.
And anyway, we kind of played it when Tav was dropping anchor against them in the second innings.
Pakistan.
And Peter May did come in at the time, and none of us knew how to kind of switch it off or anything. So somebody pressed the button and it just freeze framed it. So, but he didn't notice it because it was only a small telly and it was sort of actually just above where Chris Tavare was changing.
Right.
So he didn't really notice it, and then Tav got out, came back in, but and then sort of towelled himself down and what have you, and kind of looked at us all looking at it, and kept thinking, what are they looking at? And then he looked up the telly and saw what we were looking at.
Now, there's some real light shed on sort of various characters. A funny story about Chris Lewis ordering 10 meals off room service and having a spoonful of each, and there's some good anecdotes about
it. Did that a lot.
Yeah. And leaving the plates lying around the dressing room, around the hotel room and so forth. And Rand Dorman, there's some great character studies in your book. So, I mean,
thanks. They were very colourful people to write about. I mean, very easy to write about in some senses. You know, Derek Randall. Maybe I've reread that stuff and probably didn't do him justice because he was incredible live wire. You know. Childlike is probably wrong expression to use, but
it's unbelievable. The story about
young at heart.
Unbelievable the story where he agreed to dress up as a prostitute outside the hotel and be picked up.
Well, he dressed up in a dress. I don't think he was dressed up as a prostitute.
He was egged on by both of them, and he was picked up and was taken away in a car.
He was.
Oh, it's just extraordinary.
He was, and disappeared for quite a long time.
Yeah.
We're getting worried about him. And then he returned and said,
Peter Cook, the comedian.
Put his hand on my knee and I hit him with my handbag.
And Peter Cook, the comedian, went to La Manga with you guys, won both of them's benefit here. And,
he was a maniac.
Yeah, and just...
But very funny, I mean, you know, but sort of a kind of anarchic humour.
The woman he bought out, though, had paid to be there, actually.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Did Beefy not sort of have a chat with her afterwards or to Rainer?
No,
because
it was one of those things where he just on like an 8-hour bender every day, virtually.
Right. I mean, coming on to sort of Beefy and Essex, I mean, they're the two other sort of themes in the book. And it just sounds like, I mean, okay, I'm not being holier than that. I mean, Christ, we've had a few beers in my time. But I mean, the amount of alcohol units you guys were putting away most nights does seem rather a lot.
I think that worried the publishers in the end. They wanted me to cut out a few of the.
I mean, what do they say now?
I wanted it to be kind of warts and all.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, you didn't think about things in those days, did you, like that? I mean, what do the doctors say now? 8 pints a week, 16 units a week. I mean, sounds like you were having some of those every night, weren't you? During a match.
Certainly. I think there was a feeling then that, you know, if you drank, you know, ale, it probably wasn't going to be that bad for you. There'd be a few nutrients in it. I mean, you know, there were a couple of bowlers before our time who used to have a couple of pints for lunch. And, of course... You know, one of the few books I have read was Harold Lower's book by Duncan Hamilton and the drinking culture of the Notts dressing room in the 20s. I mean, Arthur Carr would have a bottle of champagne every lunchtime and buy Harold and Bill Vose, you know, a few pints.
The thing is, you get away with it when you're 20.
I mean, you know, when I first started, there was light ale on the table at Lord's for lunch.
Yeah.
I mean, only Ray's Dare opened it, but the rest of us had, you know, orange squash, but...
I suppose your fit young men get away with it, don't they, really?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was frowned upon to have a few drinks back then. I mean, look, Keith Fletcher, our captain, very wise man, I always thought. Very, very wise man. He always said, I don't care what you get up to of an evening on an away trip, as long as it's legal. But you've got to be ready to play for me at 11 o'clock the next day. If you're not, I'll come down on you like a ton of bricks and you'll be out of that team before you can whistle. So, you know, people knew which side of the line to stay. I mean, I used to very handily used to knock around with John Lever and Ray East mainly, and they certainly when I first started, and they showed me the ropes, and you know, Eastie was a bit mad, but he never absolutely got steamed of an evening. And JK had sweated a lot bowling, and you know, it was the usual thing: a few pints, then a curry, a few more pints, and then bed.
Fantastic. And then sort of finish off then with Ian Botham, really. I mean, his thing wasn't necessarily the drink, but it was the marijuana, wasn't it?
Well,
allegedly.
Well, he's admitted to it. So.
No, reportedly.
I mean, listen. He didn't. He liked a lot of drink as well. Beefy. He was a force of nature on and off the field. I mean, I think you know he felt the pressure, so therefore he wanted ways to relax and having a few ales and some wine and maybe the odd spliff helped him do so. I mean,
yeah, you can see that.
Probably he wasn't the only one, and he was friendly with a lot of Viv and these guys, and that's sort of part of the culture in the West Indies, to have a bit of a spliff, to chill.
So that's Derek Pringle with Hugh Turbeville, and I know, Simon, you've read this book as well as I have. I think it's good fun, actually. There's lots of sort of interesting stuff in there. One story in particular you particularly like, I know.
Well, it just caught my attention. I think it's a remarkable story. It's almost like a sort of throwaway bit. Probably many other people wouldn't find it remarkable or even comment on it. But it was the fact that Pringle, of course, was picked when he was a university student at Cambridge. Cause he'd done well as a student and he'd been playing for Essex as well. He was picked and he played his test match. He made his debut at Lord's. And then the test match at Old Trafford coincided with the varsity match. And he played for England in the test match, or he said, I'm going to play for England in the test match rather than the varsity match. I think that's just bizarre that you would have to make a choice like that. I mean, you're talking about the 1980s now. You're not talking about, you know, the 1900s. It's bizarre that he was even asked to make a choice between Old Trafford and the varsity match. Obviously, it's got to be the test match playing for England, in my opinion. But also, it was incredible as well. He was criticised for that. He was criticised for playing for England rather than playing in the varsity match, not by everybody, but by some, you know, broadsheet newspapers. He mentions, he talks about Tony Lewis, the former England captain, as criticising him in his newspaper column as he remembers it. I just find that absolutely astonishing. I really do. And it almost rendered me speechless. But I mean, there are lots of good stories in the book, good little bits and pieces, good little stories. That one just really sprang out of me. I thought, how on earth could you not play for England, you know, in preference playing for your university?
Definitely. Well, listen, it's a good book, actually. Pushing the Boundaries, Cricket in the 80s by Derek Pringle, and lots of stuff about what went on off the field as much as what went on it. It's published by Hodder and Stoughton, and if you want, as I say, to win a free copy, you can email us at theanalystpodcast@gmail.com with Pring in the subject bar and tell us your moment of the season. So we'll just come to your emails quickly, and thank you again for so many. We're just going to pick out a few here. One from Mark Ridley says, we've got cages, batting cages for batsmen and speed guns for fast bowlers. Why can't we have a knockout competition for throwing? In throwing the ball as far as you can, and then the finals, a knockout is on T20 finals day at Edgbaston, which I think is a nice idea.
Yeah, anything like that. I think entertainment during the intervals, fantastic. A throwing competition would be really good. But what's a bit like the Olympics, the javelin at the Olympics or something, or the hammer throwing at the Olympics? Just a question of how far you can throw it. So where it first lands from a sort of throw.
Absolutely. And I mean, actually, you'd have to do it at a big ground, because there are some guys who can probably throw it 100 metres now. I mean, the longest throw of a cricket ball, if you look at the Wisden, it's sort of reputed to be something like 140 yards. It's hard to believe. There's a character called George Bonner that played for Australia in the 1880s, and he was reputed to have been able to throw the ball as far as that. I don't think they've really done one recently. But anyway, you need a wide space. You'd have to go sort of diagonally across the ground, potentially, to make sure you've got enough room to do it. So that great idea for Mark Ridley, that. Someone should put that into practice. Alistair Burns says... Helmet. This is all for innovations in cricket, really. Alistair Burns says helmet cams for all batsmen to try and sort of see, you know, give more of an indication of what it's like to face fast bowling, for instance, or indeed spin, actually. What do you think?
Well, anything like that's really good. I mean, in the Big Bash and in the Blast, they use umpire cam, don't they? Umpires have got cameras in their helmets. I think that's really good for the television viewers. I think one thing... you've never been able to do, you television people, yours are in your trucks, is to show how fast the ball is coming down. You know, if you follow it as all cameras do these days from behind the bowler's arm, it doesn't look that fast. Obviously, it is, but if you show it from side on, then you do get some sort of indication of it. But you never, I don't think, as a viewer, as a TV viewer, you never quite get that indication of how rapid the bowling is, how quickly that ball comes down. It's all, you know, it's all anecdotal. So there's your next challenge.
It's one that's been on my list for a while, and we tried it on Channel 4 once with Darren Goff bowling at a plate glass positioned behind the stumps, and the ball hits it and shatters the glass. We had the camera sort of mounted quite close behind it. That was one quite good one. It is hard because of the restrictions you've got of the TV screen, which doesn't bring to life that amazing speed. I think sound can also play a part in that. But listen, it's on my list of how to do it, because you're absolutely right. And another one on my list is actually going back in time and measuring the speed of some of those old bowlers as well, which I've sort of started the process of. But the footage is a bit grainy of even the 70s, really, sort of Lillian Thompson and people like that. So never mind going back to Larwood. So... It's certainly on my list of things to do. One other thing here, Daniel Foreman says overrates. How do we speed them up? Ban glove changes for batsmen, extra drinks, etc., except during drinks breaks. So none of this sort of swapping of gloves and things like that. I mean, that's a completely reasonable thing to suggest. And I mean, bowlers don't very often go off and change their socks or their shirt.
Really?
I know people will say, well, they do sometimes. I know they run, some bowlers nip off the field. Someone like Stuart Broad nips off the field for a quick sort of loo break or whatever, and maybe he changes his socks, I don't know. But the whole glove changing thing does waste a lot of time. So the two alternatives to that, or the glove manufacturers to make better absorbent gloves or wear-inners, or just pick batsmen who don't sweat like Alistair Cook.
I suppose the one thing about bowlers going off the field is it doesn't waste time, does it? Because you go off and the 12th man comes on with a constant glove change, just slow things down.
Yeah. Anyway, look, thanks for all your emails. Keep them coming. As I say, this week we're looking at best moment of the year, cricket-wise. So send those in to us. And one final thing to say, New Cricketer magazine is out, and I mentioned it last week. Great cover. Cartoon by Newman. You'll enjoy that, if nothing else. A resume of the whole year, many good items in it, all our columnists, etc. And there is still that offer of a John Lewis voucher. If you subscribe to The Cricketer, you go to thecricketer.com/Christmas and you can get either the subscription to The Cricketer magazine and Simon Wilde's excellent book about the England Test team over the years, or a £20 John Lewis voucher. So that's a damn good offer. And I'd just like to finish by saying thank you very much for listening to us throughout this year and last year. We'll do a review of the whole year coming up for the new year. But in the meantime, I'd just like to wish you a Merry Christmas. I'm sure Simon would as well.
Yep. Happy Christmas, everybody.
And we'll speak to you soon after Christmas, reviewing the year. Thanks for listening.
Goodbye for now.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy.
Chumba.
The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes.
Chumba.
ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.